around the world with reporters.
Aziz vatandaşlarımız, kıymetli basın mensupları.
The Turkish health minister said the number of new infected cases with the coronavirus has declined due to lockdown measures imposed by the government over the past 15 days. Fahrettin Koca also said the decline was also seen in the number of fatalities. Turkey has been under lockdown since April 29th in an attempt to curb the spread of the virus. The lockdown will last till May 17th, with only tourists and those working in critical jobs allowed to move. The government introduced those measures after the daily infected numbers hit 60,000 cases per day. The health minister said more than 10 million people in the country have been given the second dose of the vaccine, with more than 14 million others receiving their first dose.
Turkey has inked agreements for a total of 240 million doses of the coronavirus vaccines developed by the Chinese firm Sinovac, Pfizer-BioNTech and Russia's Sputnik V.
The Turkish health minister announced previously that if the daily number of infections does not reach 5,000 per day, new measures are to be implemented. Analysts say that the government must take things slow and not risk opening the country again, even if this could affect the economic situation.
Despite the optimism of our health minister, his remarks show that the number of daily infections has still not reached the number set by the government, which is 5,000 to reopen the country. So I think with the data we have now, the country may go into another lockdown after May 17th, especially that the number of those vaccinated is nearly 25% of citizens.
Looking at the latest numbers given by the health ministry, it seems that Turkey must continue with the lockdown to decrease the numbers of daily infections. However, the vice president has already nulled any extension of lockdown. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
As COVID-19 cases continue to surge in Indian-administered Kashmir, Mohammad Afaq Saeed has been swamped with distress calls from people looking for oxygen. Afaq leads the oxygen campaign of a Srinagar-based NGO. His small team of dedicated volunteers is working round the clock to help COVID patients gasping for breath.
We have one of the biggest oxygen programs in this region in Kashmir. We have a lot of oxygen cylinders, a lot of oxygen concentrators, then non-invasive ventilation machines and other supportive equipment. So this way, a lot of pressure from hospitals has been released.
With the Himalayan region's healthcare system reeling under tremendous pressure, Good Samaritans and social organizations have come forward to extend helping hand to people in need. Athrod Kashmir, a prominent philanthropic organization based out of Kashmir's summer capital, has converted the region's Hajj House into a spacious 100-bed COVID center. The facility aims to cater to the rising number of COVID patients requiring hospitalization.
We have established this facility in collaboration with state administration. The facility has 28 beds with high flow oxygen capacity and 72 beds with oxygen supply. We will add 100 more beds here with oxygen support system very soon.
As hospitals are scrambling to shore up oxygen supplies, the authorities have decided to install over 30 new oxygen generating plants in the region. Also, the government is constructing a 500-bedded COVID hospital in central Kashmir's Budgam district.
The work on this project is to be completed within 35 to 40 days. The hospital will have 125 beds as intensive care unit and rest of the beds will have oxygen supply system.
Meanwhile, COVID cases continue to pile up in Kashmir, with almost 5,000 cases and 50-plus deaths being reported on a daily basis. Authorities have already extended the lockdown in the region.
As second wave of COVID-19 pandemic continues to take toll on healthcare system here, experts believe the worst is still ahead. Amid the unprecedented surge of the infections, Good Samaritans are lending a helping hand to the needy, even as fear and anxiety loom large. Said Ali Safi, Indian administered Kashmir.
The International Quds Day procession started peacefully immediately after the Friday prayers across Nigeria. In Abuja, members of the Islamic movement marched through some major streets and chanted anti-Israeli slogans. The demonstrators voiced support for the oppressed people of Palestine, saying the Quds Day has many significance.
One of the significance is that the people have been coming out, joining. Whenever people were oppressed, they learn how to come out and challenge oppressors at all costs. And here in Nigeria, we also learn from the Imam Khomeini's call, and here we are today calling for the freedom of the Palestinians, at the same time calling for the freedom of our leader, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki.
Free, free Palestine!
The procession came to an end and most of the protesters dispersed after security forces attacked them with tear gas canisters and live rounds. The Islamic movement says over 100 of its members, including women, were arrested and one person was shot.
The government has no power, no bullets, no military, no police when it comes to Boko Haram, when it comes to kidnappers. But they have every power, they have every prompt response to the Shiites whenever they are demanding for the freedom of either our leader or freedom for Palestine.
Meanwhile, in a statement, the Islamic movement in Nigeria said that terror has never been its mode of operation. The Islamic movement added, its jail leader, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki, has always believed in peace in all religious activities. The Islamic movement called on the government to release Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki. Nanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
The remaining signatories of the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, meet again in Vienna after a week-long break. Iranian lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says all sides are serious in their attempts to find a solution and revive the agreement. A major sticking point has been the list of sanctions that need to be removed by the U.S., which withdrew from the deal under the Trump administration in 2018.
The news we are getting from the Americans indicates that they are also serious about returning to the deal. Up until now, they have announced their readiness to lift a big portion of the sanctions. However, in our view, those are still not all of the sanctions that need to be removed, so negotiations will continue until all our demands are met.
Araghchi says there are still serious differences that need to be negotiated. Iran has made it clear it will only return to full compliance after the U.S. lifts all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled following Washington's withdrawal, and that it would only do so after it has verified their effective removal. The U.S. team led by Special Envoy Rob Malley has been engaged in talks with the European, Russian, and Chinese delegations in Vienna over the past weeks, but there have been no direct talks with Iran. While expert groups restart work on a draft agreement, Russian envoy Mikhail Olyanov says delegations seem to be ready to stay in Vienna as long as necessary to achieve their goal. Iran's lead delegate says the Vienna talks are not tied to the Islamic Republic's upcoming presidential elections, and that the top priority for his team is to protect the definitive positions expressed by the country's top officials. Homa Lesky, Vienna.
Marking International Quds Rally has been a usual move for Afghans over the recent years, but the threats coming from terrorist groups have prompted them to mark the event in other ways, such as holding seminars and special exhibitions. They say Afghans can fully feel the pain and misery that Palestinians are tolerating since the Israeli invasion of Palestine, because Afghans themselves have felt how difficult is the living conditions on the war, invasion and oppression due to decades of war that's still adding to the number of graveyards in this war-weary country.
This is our responsibility, to keep supporting the oppressed nation of Palestine, especially because we have commonalities with Palestinians in terms of tolerating war, invasion and oppression.
Apart from such similarities between Afghans and Palestinians, all Muslims, including Afghans, look to Al-Quds as their first Qibla that is occupied by the apartheid regime of Israel. Therefore, they say every single Muslim is responsible to raise his or her voice for liberation of Palestine as a Muslim land.
The matter of Quds is not limited to Palestine, as our first Qibla is located there. So defending Palestine means defending Islamic values. In other words, supporting the Palestinian cause means struggling to return back the occupied Palestine to the Islamic world.
Besides religious issues that link Palestine and its nation to the rest of Muslims, the vast violation of Palestinians' rights by the Israeli regime is also unacceptable for Muslims. That is why marking the International Quds Day is considered as a move to convince the international community to adopt logical measures against the Zionist regime that continues to occupy more Palestinian lands.
Calls for the liberation of Palestine are not limited to the Muslim world. Many other independent rights bodies and non-Muslim communities, mainly in the US and Europe, have also raised their voices in condemnation of Israel's inhuman acts. They believe that Palestinians will finally accomplish in their struggle to liberate their territories. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Scotland is at a crossroads yet again, a historic election that'll set the course of economic recovery and possibly open up a path towards independence from the UK. But this election, too, divisions among the voters persist.
I guess what we're looking for is a little bit of autonomy from Westminster, says the English person. We're looking for better healthcare.
Positive change for everyone.
Big one for me is about the referendum. I don't want to go down that route again.
First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, whose Scottish Nationalist Party looks set to win, says her priority, first and foremost, will be the economy, but that if voters give her the mandate for another referendum, she won't hesitate.
I think it will unleash a permanent crisis. I mean, the growth of the SNP, the appetite for independence, although we didn't secure a majority during in Diref 1, it doesn't show any sign of diminishing to any great extent. The numbers go up and down by 1 or 2 degrees. It's something which is almost permanent.
Parties hoping to scupper that plan, the Conservative, Labour and Liberal Democratic, who wish to stay in the UK. The SNP have been in power for more than a decade now, and they haven't exactly received praise for their performance in health and education, for example. But Nicola Sturgeon's response to the pandemic, her handling of the health crisis, has made her a popular leader, leaving many voters to forgive the SNP for their less successful performance in those other areas. If the SNP doesn't achieve a majority, Sturgeon could need to enter a coalition with other pro-independence parties for another referendum to become possible. Her next hurdle would be approval from British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who hasn't minced his words.
This is not the time to have a reckless and I think irresponsible second referendum. We had one only a few years ago.
The first independence referendum was held in 2014. Europhile Scots voted to remain part of the UK so they could stay in the European Union. But then came Brexit and changed that calculus. Now they're seeking re-accession. And the only way to re-enter the bloc is to exit the United Kingdom. Site for is up, Edinburgh.
The Palestinian National and Islamic Forces Committee in the Gaza Strip held a protest to support Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem al-Quds, where dozens of Palestinians are illegally displaced from their homes by force. In a press conference held during the protest, Palestinian leaders called on the international community to end this eviction that aims to demolish the Palestinian cause.
The apartheid policies and the displacement of Palestinians from their land is totally rejected by Palestinians. We stress that we won't allow the Nakba and the land grabbing that happened in 1978 to be repeated again. We are calling on the international community to stop these violations. We also call on all Palestinians to get united in order to end all Israeli conspiracies against Palestine.
Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip expressed solidarity with people in Sheikh Jarrah, and held the Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of this move. In a recent statement by Hamas military wing, its leader Mohammed Daif warned that Israel will pay a heavy price if attacks against Sheikh Jarrah continue.
The message of the Palestinian resistance to the Israeli regime for these violations against our people is clear. Jerusalem al-Quds is our red line, and the resistance won't allow such crimes to go unpunished. The Israeli occupation will pay the price if the eviction in Jerusalem al-Quds continues.
As observers say, Palestinians are forcibly displaced from Sheikh Jarrah to make way for Jewish settlers. The Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah have been stepping up their campaign to save their families from eviction in recent weeks.
We are supporting our people in Jerusalem al-Quds. The current displacement of Palestinians is totally illegal, as those are the real owners of this land. This move aims to demolish the Palestinian cause and expand the Jewish settlements. The Israeli occupation should be held accountable for these crimes.
Similar rallies have been held by Palestinians against the eviction across occupied lands.
People here stress they are all united in defending Palestinian rights, and they won't remain silent over the illegal displacement of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The Palestinian cause between interaction and disappointment is the slogan of this symposium held in the Great Mosque of Yemen's capital Sana'a to raise awareness on the importance of the Palestinian cause among Yemenis. A number of state officials participated in the symposium.
The International Quds Day is an important occasion to remind the Islamic nations of the Palestinian cause. We call on the Islamic world to take steps to liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque from the Israeli occupation amid the continued acceleration of some Arab regimes to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
The participants affirmed that the Palestinian cause will remain the central issue of the Islamic nations despite the betrayal of some Arab regimes. They said Muslims should get united to help Palestinians to liberate their territories from Israeli occupation, especially the holy city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
For the Yemenis, the Palestinian cause is not restricted to the Palestinians alone. As Imam Khomeini said, we should prepare ourselves for the military step to eradicate the cancerous gland of Israel from the region.
The International Quds Day was initiated by late founder of the Islamic Republic to express support for the Palestinians and oppose Zionism and Israel.
Yemenis believe that the Palestinian cause is a global issue that requires all the free people of the world to stand by the Palestinians until the liberation of their occupied lands. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from the Great Mosque of Sana'a.
International Quds Day is an event to express solidarity with Palestinians and oppose the Zionist regime. The day is observed by demonstrations around the world on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan. Muslims and non-Muslims communities hold rallies each year in different cities across the world to mark the occasion. Last year, Quds Day was held in Tehran and major cities like Mashhad by a procession of cars. People could attend Quds Day rallies by riding in their cars, but this year, as the situation is more critical, no rallies in person or in cars will be held. Here is a model of the Quds iconic mosque built in the holy shrine of the 8th Shia Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza in Mashhad. The dome is built to show solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians.
After the last day of month of Ramadan was named Quds International Day, we built this structure here in the holy shrine to show support for the Palestinians. This structure is 8 times smaller than the Dome of the Rock in the occupied territories. Many of our programs to support the Palestinian cause are held over here.
We also talked to some people who are called Khadim or servant. They give service to pilgrims without getting any salaries. These people have a vow with their imam to serve the pilgrims.
I've been working here for more than 32 years in this court of the shrine. I do remember that after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, this structure was built here, and since then, people hold cultural activities to show their anger at Israel.
Before the spread of the coronavirus, cultural events like exhibitions, art shows, seminars, conferences, and roundtables were held in this area, which is called Quds Court, to show solidarity with Palestinians. However, this year, to comply with the health protocols, just some restricted programs will be staged in the Quds Court of the Holy Shrine. Quds International Day is an annual event held on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. It was initiated by the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, to express support for the Palestinians and show anger at Zionism and Israel. Uman Abedi, Mashhad.
The coronavirus pandemic has spread throughout the world, killing over 3 million and infecting over 150 million people worldwide from all different backgrounds. While the virus does not discriminate, people in the Western world do.
I was walking in the park and people might shout at me like coronavirus or something. So, but like, I would say, like, it's a bit unfair to blame everything on Asians.
The conceptions around coronavirus wasn't clear why it happened, so people just wanted to blame some people, and I think that's kind of unfair to like Asians.
In major cities in the US, anti-Asian hate crime has increased by 146%, and in the UK, there's been a staggering rise of 300% in hate crime against Chinese, East and Southeast Asians.
The flagrant racism of the Trump regime, Trump and Pompeo talking about the China virus and the Wuhan virus and the Kung flu and so on, all of these tropes, racial tropes related to the coronavirus that were basically about the US administration trying to cover up its own complete uselessness when it came to containing the pandemic.
But when you look at the coverage in the mainstream media outlets in both the UK and the US, it becomes clear that the demonization of China goes much further than the Trump administration.
Very obviously linked to the escalating Cold War against China. If you look back two decades, the war on terror, the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, that happened at the same time as this massive rise in Islamophobia, in anti-Muslim racism, which really peaked in the early and mid-2000s, just at the time when we were destroying Muslim countries in the Middle East and Central Asia. So, of course, there's no coincidence. You know, racism is never a coincidence.
As long as Beijing continues to grow and threaten the West's economic dominance, it's likely that the UK and the US's hostility towards China will continue, which could be bad news for East Asian communities living in both countries. Ahmed Kabela, London.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. As you know, we're in the month of Ramadan, which is one of the most blessed months of the Islamic year. It's the month in which the prayers and acts of obedience of Allah are more readily accepted. And we're also around the nights of the Qadr, the nights of ordainment, as they're called. One of the questions which is often asked regarding this month on behalf of our Sunni brothers is that they say that the night of Qadr, the night of ordainment, was a night specifically related to the life of the Holy Prophet. Following the death of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, this night no longer occurs. This is something that is a view prevalent among some of the scholars of the Ahlus Sunnah. However, this is incorrect, and this is a very weak opinion. In some of the tafasir and commentaries of the Holy Quran, it's been related that Abu Zar al-Ghaffari, the famous companion of the Holy Prophet, says that I said to the Holy Prophet, is the night of Qadr specific to the time of the life of the prophets? And in other words, does it finish when these prophets pass away? The Holy Prophet said the following in response to him. He said, no, the night of Qadr, the night of ordainment, lasts until the resurrection, until the day of resurrection. So this is not a night which is specific to the life of the Holy Prophet. God Almighty has granted us a blessing by placing this night for all eternity until the occurrence of the day of resurrection. From this perpetuity and subsistence of the night of Qadr, we can also infer and come to another conclusion, and that's this: that it's necessary for there to be somebody who exists for all eternity until the day of resurrection, who upon whom the angels and the Spirit of God will descend on the night of Qadr. Because God Almighty says, Tanazzal inna anzalnahu fi laylatul qadr wa ma adraka ma laylatul qadr laylatul qadr khayrun min alf shahr tanazzalul malaikatu waruhu fiha, that the Spirit of God, which is probably a reference to the angel Gabriel, and the other angels descend on the night of Qadr. So there has to be somebody upon whom they descend, and obviously they only descend upon a friend of God, a wali and a friend of God. This shows us that there has to be an infallible, a friend of God, always until the day of resurrection. However, in the time of the Holy Prophet, we know that the angels and the Spirit of God descended with the Holy Quran as revelation. With the death of the Holy Prophet and the termination of prophecy and prophethood, the descent of the Holy Quran in this night finishes. Nevertheless, the other things that they descended with, the affairs that would be conducted in throughout the year, and the responsibility of that saint, that wali, or that infallible, these continue to descend, as has been mentioned in a tradition from Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the night of Qadr and its subsistence and perpetuity until the day of resurrection. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Capitalist powers have drained $152 trillion from the global south since 1960. According to new peer-reviewed research, quantifying the reproduction of inequality on the world scale. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, The $152 trillion, that's how much wealthy countries drained from the global south since 1960. Please stay tuned for more. Capitalist powers have drained $152 trillion from the global south since 1960, according to new peer-reviewed research quantifying the reproduction of inequality on the world scale. In an Al Jazeera essay written recently, three social scientists, Jason Hickel, an economic anthropologist at the University of London, Dylan Sullivan, a graduate student in political economy at the University of Sydney, and Huzaifa Zumkola, an independent scholar based in Pakistan, explained how they arrived at the $152 trillion figure, a finding they first documented in a recent paper on the plunder in the post-colonial era published in the journal New Political Economy. According to the trio, the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the Zionist regime, Japan, South Korea, and the rich economies of Europe appropriate $2.2 trillion worth of resources and labor embodied in raw materials as well as high-tech commodities like smartphones, laptops, and cars that are increasingly manufactured abroad per year from developing countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. That amount of money would be enough to end extreme poverty globally 15 times over, wrote Hickel, Sullivan, and Zumkola. Over the whole period from 1960 to today, the drain totaled $62 trillion in real terms. If this value had been retained by the South and contributed to Southern growth, tracking with the South growth rates over this period, it would be worth $152 trillion today. Imperial powers finally withdrew most of their flags and armies from the South in mid-20th century, the scholars noted. So what explains the persistence of these patterns of exploitation and extraction since then? Over the following decades, economists and historians associated with dependency theory argued that the underlying patterns of colonial appropriation remained in place and continued to define the global economy, wrote Hickel, Sullivan, and Zumkola. Imperialism never ended, they argue. They just changed the form. They were right. The authors pointed to other recent research demonstrating how global economic inequality is reproduced through unequal exchange. As the net importers of materials, energy, land, and labor embodied in the international flow of commodities, high-income nations gain a trade surplus, while lower-income nations face trade deficits. As Hickel, Sullivan, and Zumkola explained, this flow of net appropriation occurs because prices are systematically lower in the South than in the North. For instance, wages paid to Southern workers are on average one-fifth the level of Northern wages. This means that for every unit of embodied labor and resources that the South imports from the North, they have to export many more units to pay for it. Economists Samir Amin and R. Gary Emanuel describe this as a hidden transfer of value from the South, which sustains high levels of income and consumption in the North. The drain takes place subtly and almost invisibly, without the overt violence of colonial occupation and therefore without provoking protest and moral outrage. The trio found that the drain increased dramatically during the 1980s and 1990s, as neoliberal structural adjustment programs were imposed across the global South. According to the researchers, the appropriation of wealth from impoverished nations has become so significant that, for the past couple of decades, it has outstripped the rate of economic growth in the global north. In the global south, meanwhile, the losses outstrip foreign aid transfers by a wide margin. For every dollar of aid the south receives, they lose $14 in drain through unequal exchange alone, not counting other kinds of losses like illicit financial outflows and profit repatriation, the authors noted. The discourse of aid obscures a darker reality of plunder, wrote Hickel Sullivan and Zoom Koala. Poor countries are developing rich countries, not the other way around. As the researchers explained, rich countries have a monopoly on decision-making in the World Bank and IMF. They hold most of the bargaining power in the World Trade Organization. They use their power as creditors to dictate economic policy in debtor nations, and they control 97% of the world patents. Northern states and corporations leverage this power to cheapen the prices of labor and resources in the global south, which allows them to achieve a net appropriation through trade. During the 1980s and 1990s, IMF structural adjustment programs cut public sector wages and employment, while rolling back labor rights and other protective regulations, all of which cheapened labor and resources. Today, poor countries are structurally dependent on foreign investments and have no choice but to compete with one another to offer cheap labor and resources in order to please the barons of international finance. This ensures a steady flow of disposable gadgets and fast fashion to affluent northern consumers, but at extraordinary cost to human lives and ecosystems in the south. There are potential solutions, the social scientists noted. One way to fix this problem would be to democratize the institutions of global economic governance so that poor countries have a fairer say in setting the terms of trade and finance, wrote Hickel Sullivan and Zoom Koala. They continued, another step would be to ensure that poor countries have the right to use tariffs, subsidies, and other industrial policies to build sovereign economic capacity. They also said, we could also take steps toward a global living wage system and an international framework for environmental regulations, which would put a floor on labor and resource prices.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of teenagers. And the answers are mostly based upon the Quran and the narrations of our beloved Imams alayhim as-salam. I'm Hasnain, and we have in the studio our guest speaker, Sheikh Farman Ali Ma'soumi. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Farman.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Dear audience, in the previous program, we're discussing about the different ways of respecting our teenagers. And we got to know that the different ways are like by doing salam and playing with them and calling them with good names and giving them importance at public gatherings. So, Brother Farman, can you tell us any more ways to respect our teenagers?
Yeah, definitely. Because we are showing some practical examples to our dear listeners regarding these issues. So we try always to give practical and easy examples how they can utilize them in their daily lives. Yeah.
Yeah.
We just do not show and tell them the ahadith, no, practical ways also. So one of the practical ways how to respect your teenager is if you are inviting, for example, to other, you know, you are inviting, you know, your relatives, your friends to your, you know, your marriage ceremony or any other function, especially separate invitation, you have to send separate invitation for their teenagers. Usually what we do, we write invitation card in a father and mother's name and finish, you know, which is common, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's common.
They don't mind. They think that you have invited them. They, even their children will don't mind it, But if you send a separate card to their teenagers, huge respect, which will have a huge, huge impact in their
life. That's right, yeah.
You know, when they see they have got a separate card, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, you suppose you you keep yourself in the place of 13, 20, 12 years, 15, 16 years boy.
Yeah.
Then you will know how much joy and respect you'll feel by seeing a small, you know, it is a small act.
Yeah.
You know, you if you are sending one invitation, nowadays there are electronic cards.
Yeah.
So there's no extra money for you also.
True.
Just, you know, one click, one tap more.
It can also be a message,
Yeah, just write their, you know, children's names, separate names, and you can write two, three their children's name and send one invitation.
True.
Yeah. And you request your friends to do this same thing with you. You know, if you have a teenage boy or girl, you request them to write and send a separate invitation card for your children.
Okay.
And this will show them that they are respected. They have respect in their, you know, in others' heart for them. Even we can't imagine how much big an impact it will have on them.
That's right. It's very simple and easy.
Yeah, very simple and easy. Just we have to pay attention. We have to remind ourselves and our friends to do this, inshallah.
Inshallah.
Another way to show respect to your children is praise them in front of others. Yeah, whatever they have done, show their work in front of others and praise them. This will have also again huge, huge impact, and it will boost their, you know, moral and it will boost their, you know, in their respect also.
Thank you so much, Brother Farman. And dear audience, let's take a short break over here.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Yeah. Welcome back to your audience. And before the break, we were discussing about the another way of respecting our teenagers, which is praising them in front of others. Brother Farman, please continue.
Yeah, as I said, it will have a very, very huge impact in their life. Even we can't imagine how much big.
True.
Let me share about, myself.
Please.
An incident. When I was in class 6.
Uh-huh.
In 6th class, maybe the children are 12, 13 years
yeah.
old. Maybe
yeah.
somehow less than
yeah, like then 12, is around
12
yeah.
13. So I was, 12 years of age.
Yeah.
So in my school, I had got the most marks in my school, in whole high school. You know, in subcontinent, they have from 6 to 10,
yeah.
they have high school. Yeah.
yeah.
In Iran, from 7 to
10.
12.
Yeah, 12.
So
yeah.
They have high school system. So I was in high school, and in annual result function, they announced that I had got the most marks.
Yeah,
so my brother, elder brother, is
yeah.
a teacher.
Yeah.
So in a very important meeting,
yeah.
we had some officers of, educational,
yeah,
department.
Yeah, educational ministers.
Not
yeah.
ministers, in educational department.
Uh-huh, people from the department, yeah.
Yeah, department, like secretary or something
yeah.
else. But those were very important people. So in that gathering, my brother introduced me and told them that he has got this much marks
uh-huh.
and he has topped this school.
Uh-huh,
so they
nice.
Gave me some prize, for example, at that time 100 rupees or 50 rupees.
Yeah.
So I cannot forget this incident until now,
uh-huh.
how much big.
So there was a huge respect.
Huge,
for you, yeah.
huge respect.
True.
I was like flying.
Uh-huh.
So this can have a very, very important
mm-hmm,
impact in our
yeah.
teenagers' life. So
that's
praise
true.
Them, but do not praise them a lot.
Uh-huh.
So
do
not
spoil
exaggerate.
Them?
Yeah, it can have bad impacts
uh-huh.
also. It can spoil them also. But choose very, very good, important
yeah.
occasions and praise them. Praise
we
their
need
work.
To be moderate.
Yeah, moderate. Another way is to listen to them carefully.
Uh-huh.
This also shows that you are respecting your teenager. In so many programs, I have said that our Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was khayru udhun, the most, the best listener on this earth,
uh-huh.
Rasulullah. When somebody would talk to Rasulullah, he would completely face towards him
yeah,
and
full attention.
Full attention.
Yeah.
As if the speaker himself, he would think that he is 100% listening to me and
uh-huh.
he is paying respect and showing respect towards me.
Yeah.
So if you are listening to your teenagers,
yeah.
if they understand you are paying attention,
uh-huh.
then again this will show that you are respecting them. And they will understand mm-hmm. definitely you are respecting them.
That's right.
And again, it will have, inshallah, very good impact in their life.
Thank you so much, Brother Farman. And your audience, let's take a short break over here.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back to your audience. And before the break, we were discussing about another way of respecting our teenagers, which was listening to them carefully. Brother Farman, please continue.
Yeah, definitely being a human being, if you're talking to somebody and he's not paying attention to you,
yeah.
that we feel that he is betraying us somehow, yeah?
Yeah.
So you never want to talk to him again. You do
mm-hmm.
not want to respect him again because
yeah.
he's not listening to you.
Sure.
So if you listen carefully,
yeah.
no matter whatever they are discussing,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, parents, fathers and mothers,
yeah.
they straight away, they cut their, talks.
Mm-hmm.
They don't listen to them and they say something else. No.
So it's like disrespecting the children.
Yeah. No matter whatever he's talking, first listen to him completely.
Yeah.
Then you can give your own opinion about whatever he's demanding, whatever he's asking. So if you cut his talks, means you are disrespecting him. And if he understands that you are disrespecting him, then definitely it will, you know,
it'll have a bad impact.
Bad impact, definitely. Then he will also have the same, you know, reaction with you. And he will not also listen to you.
It'll worsen up the things.
Worsen up the things, in, yeah, definitely. So being a good listener, it is a very, very important skill. You know, skill. You have to train yourself up to listen.
And we need to learn that.
Even between husband and wife. This is a very, very important and golden rule. Everybody should utilize it in his personal life. Another way to show respect to your children, your teenager, is you ask for his opinion. Whenever you make any decision regarding your, you know, house, your any personal life, your social, any issue you are, you want to make any decision, you ask for his opinion. By asking his opinion, you are showing that he is very important to you. You are respecting
him. It'll make them
him.
Feel important.
Yeah, definitely, after 12 years, he's, you know, complete. Mostly he can give, he can share his ideas with you. Sometimes it can be, most of the times it can be helpful for you also. Yeah, but more than you, it is beneficial for him, for your son or daughter. It can help them building you the inner confidence. If they have this confidence, inshallah, they will be respectful towards you also in the future. So by sharing with them, you know, asking them to share their opinions with you, you are giving this opportunity of, you know, feeling respectful. They will feel respectful. They will feel that they are very, very respectful towards you, and you are respecting them also.
Thank you so much, Brother Farman, for joining us, and thanks so much, dear audience, for staying with us. And in this program, we discuss about more different ways of respecting our teenagers. And we have said that one of the ways is giving them separate invitation, that whenever you invite the family to any gathering, so you need, if you give a special or separate invitation to the children, they'll this will make them feel special, and this will make them feel respected. And the other thing which we said was praise them in front of others. So like when we praise them in front of others, this this thing will again make them feel special and important. So this is really important. So and the other thing which we said was listen to them carefully. As we said that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was the best listener. So we should learn from him, and we should listen carefully to what children are trying to say us. So this will make them feel respected again. And the last one which we said was you know, asking their opinions. Like when there's any family discussion or anything, we should ask children their opinions. So this will make them feel important, and this will boost their self-confidence, and it will make them feel respected. Thank you so much, Brother Farman, and thank you so much to your audience for staying with us. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.